Welcome, John. Thank you so much for doing this.
It's great to see you, Jonathan.
Nice to see you as well. Yeah, it's a dream come true for us at SBL, so really appreciate you being here and making the time.
I'm thankful that you guys asked.
Yeah. And welcome back to Brooklyn. So you're from Brooklyn, right? You grew up
there? East Flatbush. This is Williamsburg, so we're not incredibly far away from East Flatbush, but, you know, Brooklyn's a big place.
It is. Yeah. It is. It is. It's a whole other place. Yeah. So what was it like, you know, growing up here at such a fertile time for music? I mean, that's such 60s. A great time. 60s, right? I mean, tell me, take me back there, what it was like and what was on the radio.
Well, I remember in our house, because it was a serious heavyweight Italian scene, but my parents liked music, and it wasn't just that. Like, my dad would be singing along with opera records, but we also heard in the car a lot of Motown music, the Beatles. Mm. And oddly, at the time, I remember there was we had like one of those cedar box Victrolas with the legs.
Piece of furniture.
Yeah. And there were five of us. I mean, we didn't have a lot of stuff. My father grew up poor, and my mother did too. But we had, you know, we shared a house with my uncle and his family in East Flatbush. And so I remember, which is really wild, because it was a Glen Campbell record also that we had with all these Jimmy Webb tunes, like Wichita Lyman and all these famous. Little did I know that was going to be a thing too. But I remember the thing that made me want to play the electric bass was hearing Jameson on two Stevie Wonder records. One was I Was Made to Love Her, and the other was For Once in My Life. And I remember being a kid in my father's Chevy. And for some reason, I think that there's the radio in that car was pretty good. The bass was loud.
Mm.
And of course, on those Motown records, it was mixed up front.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing those songs, those two. And I didn't even know that I was going to be in music, but I remember just being captivated by that. And when I remember crying when Stevie Wonder played his harmonica solo, it was so emotional to me For Once in My Life.
Mm-hmm.
I used to get tears.
Mm.
So there was something there.
Mm.
And then my brother, I guess I had a cousin who played some guitar. He wound up being a Irish fiddler, like the only Italian guy ever to go to Ireland and win one of those fiddling contests.
Oh,
apparently.
Wow. Oh,
his name,
wow.
He went by Tony Cloud. His name is Tony DeMarco. But we didn't really, he lived across the street, and I think my brother inherited one of his hand-me-down guitars. My grandfather on my mother's side got my brother a guitar at first. It was a Harmony Hollywood.
High-end stuff.
Yeah. So he started taking guitar lessons, and I wanted to be like him. He's 3 years older. We're very close. He still lives in the Bay Area. Great guitar player, great teacher, and a pastor, too. So he started studying with this guy named Jimmy Gilmartin in Brooklyn, who made everybody learn how to read music. So when I wanted to be like my brother, so they brought me to this guy, Jimmy Gilmartin. They put the guitar on. I'm lefty. So I have it. I'm playing the guitar righty, like I still play righty. They put a pick in my hand, and they got the Mel Bay book, and you got to play Little Brown Jug, and I hated it. I was about 8 or something like that, 8, 9. It didn't go.
Mm.
I hated it. Because I had a pretty good ear, and I just wanted to play by ear. I didn't want to learn how to read music, and I didn't for a while. So my brother sort of peeped it. He's always been he's an amazing guy and always very nurturing to his little brother. So he kind of figured out maybe he would like the bass without the pick. Nobody thought about turning it around because only Hendrix and we didn't even know about Hendrix yet.
Right, yeah.
You know, so this must have been around, let's see, I was born in 67. So I started playing in 69 because I was 10. My brother, we found Sears Telstar, horrible short scale bass with labellas on it.
Yeah.
I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And he put it in my hands. And I went, wow, this feels good. Mm. Like my finger, like there was nothing between me and the instrument.
And this is after you had heard Jamerson. So you knew
it was all kind of concurrent, but I didn't really know. I just felt this thing on the record.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, what do you know? I was, you know, but I heard this thing and I was like, wow, that really kind of shook me. So I took to the bass. I really loved it. And I remember the first thing I learned was the easiest thing for me to learn was 25 and 6 to 4 by Chicago, because it was just like, you know, like A, G, F, and E. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great. I actually figured it out, and I thought I was something, right?
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing. But I had an ear, so I could figure some stuff out. I had I was just hammering on the bass.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I heard a lot of those Motown records, and I was like, wow, this is... And that really stayed with me. And so my first heroes, without even knowing who they were at first, was definitely Jameson. And I was probably hearing some Chuck Rainey on records too, but I didn't know who he was yet.
Right. It was Atlantic Records.
Yeah, America, yeah.
That was kind of coming out.
And then we moved to California in 72.
Okay.
And that's where I encountered Chris Paylor. He was a musician. He had a big band. He was played both instruments. He was a great arranger, composer. He even ghost wrote for films.
Mm.
Did a lot of composing for hire. He made me learn how to read music. He introduced me to Chuck Rainey on those records, whether it was a Crusaders record or an Aretha record or later on Steely Dan. I heard him on my own. I already knew who he was by then, but also Roberta Flack and different stuff. So I was hearing him too. He wound up, I would say, in terms of my studio playing, which happened later when we moved to L.A., we moved to L.A. in 78, and I moved up to town in 82. Just a short biographical sketch. But anyway, hearing those Motown guys and also the way they put bass lines together, and also hearing McCartney on all the British Invasion stuff, there was a sense of bass lines. You know, if you grew up in that era, bass lines were 2 and 4 bar patterns. They were hooks. They made the song what it was a lot of times. Also, I heard Lee Sklar play ballads. I heard Joe Osborne play ballads. I didn't know any of these names. I just remember songs, right?
Yeah.
And they put this thing in my head that the bass was, not even knowing all this intellectually, just feeling that the bass was, you know, pivotal for the music, for the rhythm. It was something, because I wanted to play the drums. In Brooklyn, I had bongos and maracas.
So you're always drawn to rhythm.
I
mean, rhythm
I wanted to play the drums. My dad said, we got 5 kids with your uncle, and forget about it. No drums, you know, forget
enough,
it.
Enough people around here.
Yeah, so I had my bongos. And the funny thing was that I have an early memory sitting with a radio in my room in Brooklyn. And this would have been, you know, 68, 67, listening to the radio, whatever was on the pop radio, WABC.
Right.
And like playing bongos along with the songs, but I would lay out if it didn't fit.
Mm.
So I was already kind of thinking about how rhythm worked, I didn't know anything,
sure.
But just feeling like, wow, this doesn't fit on this tune.
Mm-hmm.
But the Motown tunes always fit.
Yeah.
They always had a percussion thing going.
Mm.
And so my brother and I, then we discovered in that period, still living in Brooklyn, because we listened to PLJ.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather, who was in World War II, somehow he had a Grundig, one of those. That was the first time I ever heard Jaco was on that same Grundig, too, later on in California.
Mm-hmm.
It traveled with us to California. But I remember hearing B.B. King on WPA and Hendrix and Cream with Clapton. And then The Who. Who's Next was a big record in our house too. So then all this stuff was happening. When we moved to California, all of a sudden I started hearing about Chick Corea and all these things. Then I heard Stanley Clark.
Right.
And then I was listening to Coltrane and Bird. I got way into Bird because Bay Area was very jazz conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And Tower of Power, Larry Graham. All the gospel stuff was happening with the Hawkins family.
Paul Jackson
was a huge influence. Uh-huh. So it was Paul and Rocco Prestia from, those were the biggest influences. It took a little while for me to catch up to the slap thing. I didn't really get into that until I went to LA and it was mandatory.
Right.
You had to know how to do it well.
80s sessions in LA, it was a...
So late 70s, early 80s, I started trying to fool around. It was weird for me because, again, if I had turned my hand around, it would have been easy.
Right.
I can do that all day, but this I had to really work at getting that loose.
Mm.
It took me a while.
That's interesting. Do you think, I'm curious, not only obviously you've been playing bass a long time, but as an educator, you've been around so many bass players. What do you have to say about the personality type? Do you think there's something about a person's spirit that gets to be drawn toward bass?
Yes.
And how would you characterize that?
I think some reason we're composers at heart.
Mm.
We take an interest in the whole enchilada, what Ron Carter calls the big M of music. So, yes, we are enamored with those groove bass parts that make the song go, and the pocket and all that stuff, even when we're too young to even know what it is, we're drawn to learning those 2- and 4-bar patterns that are hooks.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately. That's what...
It's the soul of the song, right?
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's
you know, when you hear, I mean, that changed my life.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who he was. He didn't get credit for until later, you know?
That's crazy.
But that, I'm a Motown head. Like, I just love that. And I think that served me well when I went to the studios in L.A. because I remember sitting down, because older musicians always took me under the wing and they told me, look, it's great that you love to play jazz too, but lean on your R&B roots. That's what's going to, you know, people care about your feel. And if you can come up with a great bass part, learn how to cultivate 2- and 4-bar patterns. Like, you should be able to, like, so what I used to practice when I, because I started to hear Abraham Labrille was a friend, and I heard Nathan was on the scene, Steubenhaus, obviously you had Lee Sklar and all these people. I noticed that when I heard records that were coming out also, I was really into Anthony Jackson already. And then Marcus is my contemporary. We're the same age, roughly. Started hearing him when I was in college on records and going, wow. His slapping thing actually influenced the way I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I noticed that everybody was really good about coming up with these magical parts.
Right.
And even before I knew about those guys, those were the bass lines that, like, I just played for you. It was a Jameson bass line. That's a hook.
And McCartney, too.
So that kind of stuff was the basis for our childhood. My brother and I, and then later on, when I got to LA, I realized that those guys kept working all the time because they were able to, you know, in LA, somebody would just come in, maybe they didn't have anything written down. They'd play it on the big speakers. This is my song. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to come up with a bass line that was memorable to fit that song.
Right. And quick.
Yeah. There would be you had to learn how to read. Thank God Chris Paylor made me learn how to read. I started trying to learn how to read at 13. It took me a while, but by the time I was in, you know, high school and college, I started to get better at it, and then I became a studio guy in L.A., so I had to do it. But even as important as the reading was, which it was for that music, to be able to play on a film, to be able to play on a jingle, to be able to play on a record, sometimes you had arrangers that wrote chord charts with some written, a little vibe that everybody had to play together, or nothing. Me coming in having to have the ear, which the ear was cool for me. That was what I started on. So put the music up on the speakers. Oh, okay, scribble out a chord chart because they don't have anything. So not only did I have to be able to transcribe and come up with the harmonies and understand that, then I had to interpret it and come up with a hook. So that was really good training. I remember wanting to get into the studios really bad, and I moved up in 82, and I used to, daily, one of my practice routines was choose a different metronome setting and put it on and try to come up with a 2- or 4-bar pattern that was a hook. Didn't matter the key, just the tempo. Again, we, you know, you and I were talking before we got on camera about the primacy of rhythm. Rhythm is everything.
Yep.
It's the delivery system for everything in music that we like.
Or else it's just amorphous mess,
notes,
right?
On the floor until we breathe life into them.
Yeah. Were you always oriented toward rhythm? Like you said, you were playing bongos along with the radio.
I really wanted to play drums.
Yeah.
That was, and so.
So that's something bass players have in common, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think we have a love for that, a passion, and some guys actually play good drums on the bass.
Sure.
I'm okay. I'm not so great.
Right.
Because I didn't start early enough, and I wasn't, because of my dad, I wasn't able to get a drum set until I was an adult musician and finally got one, you know, in my own. When I finally lived in a house where I wouldn't be disturbing anybody.
Yeah.
Before that, when I lived in a condominium in LA, I had one of those funny, because I was with Yamaha by then, one of those practice kits that doesn't make any noise.
Uh-huh.
It's like a surface. And then I would put t-shirts on the cymbals and practice. So, and being around great drummers all my life.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I got the gig with Chick, I had already been playing with Vinny and all these guys and all the session guys in New York, in LA, so I should say. When I met Dave Weckl, he turned me on to this book called New Breed by Gary Chester, who was one of his teachers. Gary Chester was a studio drummer in New York, even before Steve Gadd was breaking in.
Mm.
And he wrote this whole thing about, he called them systems. So there would be a line of music for each limb, and then you would have to sing a rhythm too.
Mm.
So I'd be in my hotel room on those Chick Corea tours, early tours. Dave, I got the book, and I would be sitting there, you know, hi-hat foot, bass drum foot, you know, ride cymbal or hi-hat snare drum, and I would be reading these things and trying to sing
wow.
another thing.
And they're all independent. All
yeah,
your,
yeah,
wow,
and feeling like completely uncoordinated, but it was good for me.
Yeah.
And then later on, of course, you know, I'm a huge Elvin Jones fanatic, so I always practice. I do this a lot. Practice a swing rhythm or a 6/8 bell pattern, and then see if I can fill in other parts of the triplet with my other three limbs.
Mm. The times here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's a great practice. I make my students do drums and uh-huh. piano. And I got into piano because my brother was majoring in music at Cal State Hayward. And so 3 years behind, my parents had to get a spin a piano so he could do his class piano stuff.
Uh-huh.
They got a cheap little Cheney and Sons,
yeah.
you know. And there's a piano in the house all yeah. of a sudden. So I started gravitating. And there was a guy named Frank Sumares, mm-hmm. great pianist.
Mm-hmm.
He mentored a lot of people in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
Great player. Grew up with Pharoah Sanders.
So. Oh, wow.
He taught me some voicings. And then I was off and running,
right.
trying to write and stuff. But again, it was the rhythm of those great piano players and the way they comped that wanted me to be able to play those voicings. And it wasn't just like blah, blah, blah. It was like hearing Herbie comp or Wynton Kelly or, you know, Chick and Herbie. And
yeah. I mean, how would you, and I'm curious, how would you advise, you know, what one of the advantages in a way of having come up when you did was there wasn't oversaturation, right? Like you listened to what was on the radio, you went to the record store, you bought a new record when it came out, and you weren't inundated with all this content and data and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, how do you get students to focus in on this stuff, on rhythm, on developing piano, when there's just noise? Like,
right.
What is the solution there?
Transcription is one of the most powerful things, and it's also very misused often. What's important is that you get the feel, the sound, the articulation, every breath, every... That's how I got way into Wes Montgomery. That was in the box of records that my grandfather brought home when my brother and I were young in Brooklyn.
That was the jazz influence, right?
Yeah, one of the biggest. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
well, it wasn't even his record collection. He used to work manual labor on the street. And in New York, when you're moving, they put stuff out when they don't want anymore. And one of the saxophone players, friends of mine, said, those records would have never been on the street unless there had been an argument in that house about something.
Somebody blew the rent money on something.
Because all of a sudden, these records, there was Art Blakey, there was Jimmy Smith, there was Ray Charles, Genius Plus Soul Equals Jazz, Wes Montgomery. And so my brother and I were hearing stuff like, what is it? Yeah. I think I did this octave. So that phrasing, you know, kind of Wes-isms.
Mm-hmm.
When people started to say, when I got my six chain, they said, wow, that's a different thing. What's your concept? That sounds different. I said, it's just Wes Montgomery down an octave.
Exactly. It wasn't about writing it out and hoping through osmosis that would...
No, I learned it by ear.
You learned by ear, right.
Yeah, and I did later on when I got into Schofield and Brecker and
right.
certain other people, I would write, you know, a whole solo out or part of the solo. I got into Giant Steps as a young kid, you know, trying to figure out what is that, you know, and learning parts of it and then getting a transcription and learning a lot of it. But I still do transcription. A few years ago, because I've been teaching for 45 years.
Yeah.
Even as a kid in you know, in the Bay Area, in the East Bay, as a teenager, I was teaching guys in their 20s coming to the house. It was weird, actually. I look back on it now. My mom was like, who's this guy? You know, and so, that was only because of my brother. I was able to do that because my brother grounded me in all this stuff. I learned the little, my scale fingerings, like the Segovia, like this, the basic, that, you know, or different things. And I learned how to do two octaves. And he set up my hand well because I was playing like this before that.
Right.
I had like the club big time with the thumb over the top.
He gave you some legit technique.
Yeah, it just made it a lot easier, but I didn't like it at first. Uh-huh. He was like, you got to play like this now. I was like, what do you mean? This is comfortable, you know?
So, do you have a transcription process that, or has it just evolved over the years? I mean, do you use any of the new, I mean, all these things now you can slow stuff down. And
I use the slow downer for some of those Coltrane licks, which there's no way be accurate until you slow those down, because when he's going, you know, it's like, that's, you know.
What's amazing when you do that, you realize there's still a system. It still makes sense, right?
Like I remember hearing, like for me, it was a triumph, and this was before the slow downer when I, you know, those kind of trainisms that I learned by ear. It took me a minute because I was like, the needle goes back and what the heck is that? You know, so, but to me, again, it was about the rhythm. The notes were cool, but the notes there's only 12 notes and okay. But it was the feeling.
Yeah.
You know, like on a blues, I always talk about, there's always an emotional content to everything that gets explained by theory, but comes from a soulful place. Mm. Like Train, if he's playing F blues, you could analyze and say, well, yeah, he does a lot of triad combining between E flat triad and F triad. Mm. Okay, but if somebody does that and they haven't really heard Train, it's not going to sound like when he goes, he'll go, you know, like that.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff, you know, that's he'll go,
how important are those inflections and articulations?
That's everything.
I mean, yeah.
Otherwise, it just sounds like you're playing some triads.
Yeah.
To me, it was like... Now, I'm left-handed, so all that pulling off and hammering, for me, not even knowing it, was more natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that till later, until the slap thing came in, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, my God. But my right hand was not as limber as my left hand.
Mm-hmm.
So for Train and all that, it works great.
It worked out great. Yeah, right.
But sense. I had to work really hard for the other stuff.
Mm.
Just the looseness, because this was too tight. I had to loosen up the right hand.
Mm.
And it worked, but I always felt like my right-handed friends were just blazing on that stuff. And it was they were struggling with all this other stuff that it was easier for me. So it's always, you know, it's always balanced.
Thing as a free lunch. Really.
No, we all have our strengths and weaknesses. Yeah. And there's, you know, but for me, because of the blues, like BB and all that, you know. All that kind of stuff, it's all inflection. It's one sound.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, oh, we have like all these, you know, chords and all. No, it's three chords and the truth, right?
Yeah, yeah,
or sometimes, if it's Mississippi Fred McDowell, it's one chord and the truth. You know, so you got like a... you know, that kind of stuff. I love that stuff. Yeah. I'm perfectly happy listening to that, you know. Mm. And I think because I was around guitar, my brother's a good guitarist, and so we listened a lot to different people, and the guitar always captivated me, but I can't play it because it's too small. My fingers are little Italian sausages, and they don't really, like, fit, and I can't. I don't understand how guitar players can play those chords with that right. little room.
There's that major third, too.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it's much easier to do this. You know, all this kind of stuff on the six string, because there's room.
Yeah, makes sense.
You know, so it was a weird, like, confluence of all these influences. I heard Italian opera. I have the same birthday as Puccini and Bottesini, but yet it was really the African-American cultural experience that grabbed me early. And then later on, I was mentored by all these incredible African-American heroes that actually took me in. They didn't need another bass player. They had all the best ones.
Yeah.
So what they did was a huge blessing. And I feel like I have a debt of gratitude that I'll keep trying to say thank you for until I die. Mm-hmm.
Played with so many iconic musicians. I'm curious, you know, across, you know, the whole spectrum of styles, do you notice some thread that connects them? Is there something about people that make the mark in the way they do? Something about their spirit, their approach?
Yeah, I think fearless is the word that comes to mind. Mm. And nonconformist a lot of times too, because they don't just take what people say at, like, you know, as face value. They have an inner, you know, compass that they're following.
There's, like, a vision.
Yeah, and they're not afraid to fail. Hmm. Particularly when I think of, like, Chick was the first one that took me all around the world, and he introduced me to Herbie and Wayne and all those guys. And I played a little bit with Freddie, too, in L.A. But I played with Claire Fisher. I played with all these people, and later on, McCoy, Hank Jones, you know, all the, like, for me, sitting here, I really can't even believe it. I'm just a guy from East Flatbush. You know? I was a kid with no like connections in the music world. Or right. I couldn't even read music. Right. So I had a really nice conversation with one of my heroes on the phone, who I've gotten to know a lot over the years, Ron Carter. So he's one of my absolute, in terms of walking and line construction, he's a master architect of music. Mm-hmm. And the way he played with Miles's band in the 60s changed my life. And it actually, you know, I've been sort of following him as an example. I wound up playing with a lot of the people that he played with, but, you know, much later. And he was like a compass for me. And that's how I was able to function in Wayne Shorter's quartet for the 20 years that we had until Wayne.
There is, I see that connection. There's a spontaneity, you know, with Wayne's band that I connect to that.
There's fearlessness.
Quintet with Miles, fearlessness, yeah.
Yeah, and that was, you know, those guys, that band is so, you know, so much a, you know, heroic thing for us, like for the guys in our band with Wayne, it's, you know, with Danilo and Brian and I, and it's like, you know, I remember when we were first starting out with that band 20 years ago, whenever it was, Herbie would come to every gig in LA to see us.
Cool.
And he was very encouraging. And one day he said, you know, you guys are an extension of what we were doing. And we were like, come on. I mean, because that stuff to us is magic. It's still, right. Even when I listen to it now, even though I've been playing music all my life and I kind of get what they're doing a lot more now.
Sure.
Even though I understand what's happening, it's still magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I hear Fall or Nefertiti or Miles Smiles or just that thing. And that's, Ron informed a lot of the way, you know, even though I started on electric and I've been playing acoustic for a long time, they cross-pollinate. Mm. So Ron affects me a lot on this instrument when I'm playing jazz, which you'll hear when we play with Yo Tom and stuff. And the electric part of me made it possible for me in session work sometimes to play music that was more on the funky side when they wanted acoustic doing that.
Right.
As right. opposed to some guys who are much more, they don't like all kinds of music, so they would never like to play on something like that. For right. me, that's
you're excited
like,
to get
great,
there. Yeah,
let's
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's interesting. You're obviously well known as you know one of the great doublers in playing acoustic and playing electric. One of the things about acoustic, yeah, I know from the playing I've done on it, is it's so much about getting that sound, right? I mean, how to get sound, you're wrestling with this giant thing. And then I think a lot of guys and women, when they approach electric, they just don't think of it the same way, right? They let the amp do the work. How do you get a sound?
Well, I practiced from when I was a kid, and still, most of the time when I practice, it's like this.
So if it sounds good, acoustic.
Yeah, if you can get a sound.
Yeah.
And I do this with my students over the years. Can you pull a sound out of the instrument, or is your instrument set up with the action so low that you can't do this?
And what part of it to you is set up, and what part of it is touch?
Well, it's
and
intention
feel,
that dictates the setup, right? For me,
right.
it's always like, what kind of music do you want to play? What kind of techniques do you need to play that music? And what is your setup going to need to be to play the music that you want to play? For me, early on, I guess I gravitated to a lot of guys that were dig-in kind of players. Mm. Jameson, for sure. Chuck Rainey.
Mm-hmm.
Will Lee, too.
He
digs in.
Yep.
Now, there's a lot of other guys that I absolutely love that play lighter. Mm-hmm. Like Marcus has a light setup.
Mm-hmm.
He has a lot of dynamic range. There's not many people who do that to me, of the guys that play really low action. Most of them sound a little monochromatic to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hear, and this is where the classical training influenced me, sound production. Can you play this note like that? And I mean, how much dynamic range do you actually have?
Mm-hmm.
Most electric bass players don't have much.
Mm.
And I'm not tooting my horn. I'm saying those teachers that I had that kicked my butt about dynamics,
right.
they molded me. Because when I was playing double bass with a bow, if you didn't play dynamics, you'd get yelled at. You
right.
know, it's like, it says double piano. That kind of stuff, you know. So
yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, there's such a sensitivity to dynamics in classical music.
Yeah.
There really is.
And so world. That informed sonic, you know, and me, you know, that's what really influenced me too, was the sound of everybody, like hearing Jameson, hearing Chuck Rainey. Willie Weeks was a huge thing. Chris Paylor introduced me to Donny Hathaway live. I was 13. I learned that whole solo.
Incredible. Yeah.
It just freaked me out. It changed my life. Yeah. You know, all that kind of stuff. That totally changed. That wiped me out. I was like, how is it that he could create? And there you talk about a groove. He starts with a very simple groove. He's very patient. It's very compositional.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's kind of like in jazz, there's a parallel with him, like Jimmy Garrison or somebody, like really patient and able to spin this web.
Yeah. It's like chapters of a book he's writing in real time or something.
Yeah. And that freaked me out. And Chuck Rainey, like all those little things, those nuances are what, when I started becoming a teacher, I realized how to sort of group them. But like just hearing, Chuck Rainey do something like, all those little things.
Mm.
I stole so much from Chuck Rainey. I mean, it's not even funny. When it comes to playing, like, you know, groove music and having those little emotional inflections, they're not, you know, it's not notey. It's
not a lick.
It's sound, and it's just a feeling. It's like a breath.
Right.
That's what really moved me, and I didn't even know what I was doing. That's why sometimes when people, after Chick, because we were playing all that, you know, wild music, this, oh, yeah, he's just a fusion guy. I was like, man, if you only knew. I spent so much time in L.A. just being a session guy playing one note.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And like, when I first came in, it was like...
Yeah.
You know, it was like all of a sudden it went from Jameson in the 70s. All of a sudden, overnight...
Just, Yeah.
Gone. And like click, dumb playing with clicks.
Yeah.
And boom.
Boom. Yeah.
Yep. Boom. Like with the bass drum, like those 16th notes were so measured, they were so even.
Right.
You had to really get that. You couldn't inflect in a different way, and there was no wiggle room because the click. And that was an education for me, coming from that freer, expressive kind of funk playing,
right,
which totally dictated my life. Reining it in, and then at the same time, at the very same time, hearing Stanley with Chick and going to see Return to Forever at the Berklee Community Theater in 1975, and seeing Stanley just go ballistic. I mean, just crazy.
Yeah.
And with freedom that I, you know, it was, you talk about a bass, he was the first real bass hero. He enjoyed a crossover into British rock and roll. He did stuff that nobody still has done that.
Mm-hmm.
Played acoustic and electric on a high level. Was known as a household word. People didn't even know about bass. They knew who Stanley was.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Still.
And he really influenced me, you know, in his ability to, like, walk in a Ronish way, but at the same time play electric and in that, I don't know, in that Stanley way.
Oh, yeah.
And even when Jaco came out, and I loved Jaco, and I got totally into that too. I learned every note of that solo record.
Mm-hmm.
And between me and this other guy that I was growing up with at the time, his name was Jim Stout, in the Bay Area, we figured out all of Portrait of Tracy.
Really?
I had most of it, but I couldn't even show me some of this stuff, you know, the one
where you're fretting stuff. And the false harmonic.
And now I've forgotten a lot of it, but I love that stuff. And
yeah.
But I never stopped respecting Stanley for what he did too, because he was more versatile.
Yeah.
He could play with Joe Henderson.
Yep.
Or he could play in Return to Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Or he could play School Days.
Yep.
Or he had those crazy bands where he had another bass player and he was blowing on his piccolo bass. He just did a lot of stuff. He didn't care. He was very...
There's the fearlessness.
The fearlessness was very evident. And Jaco, obviously, he was like Galileo. He just, for the fretless bass, you know, he was like an explosion. As Anthony was Galileo for the six-string bass. And without him, I wouldn't be sitting here in terms of finding this thing that suited my soul, you know, in a different way. I wasn't doing it so that I could play a lot of notes. That's what... I don't like it when people say that, because I did it for compositional reasons and orchestration reasons in that band. I only picked it up because I got in that electric band and it was a trio and we were playing electric and acoustic music, only the three of us, for a while, early 85. And he was going crazy. You know, he had all this stuff going, and then, you know, he'd play a solo and then it was like my turn. I was like, oh my God,
what am I
supposed to do with this? Right. You know?
Yeah.
And he had those synths with the really low notes, and I wanted to be the low note guy.
Yeah.
Did what he did, and fearless, everybody said, oh, you're gonna get tendonitis to him, and then they said that to me, oh, you're trying to do like, you're gonna hurt yourself, and I was like, I don't know, I gotta try, you know.
I mean, it seems like, you know, like many of us, the people you're really drawn to are the people who have a voice.
Yeah.
How what do you tell students about, we all want to develop a voice, we all know we have one in here somewhere, how do we get that out on the instrument?
Yeah, I think now, after, you know, being on this side of it, I even had, you know, my teacher saying, well, you got to find your own voice. You're born with your voice. You're born in your family of origin. You hear syntax and rhythm in the way your parents or whoever happens to raise you speak. You listen to some of their music, and then you find music that you like. The way your voice is cultivated is when you do the work to get the mechanics out of the way so your soul can shine through the instrument.
Mm.
So there's a certain amount of work you got to do to uncover your voice, because your voice is going to get muted if you can't.
You have to have vocabulary to speak.
Yeah, like when you, this, and this fluently applies to jazz. You just touched right on exactly the thing. When we grow up and we hear our parents speak, we wind up copying their rhythm, their syntax, the vocabulary they have, the accent, the rhythm of it. And nobody hands us a grammar book till much later. We memorize it by ear. Same when people say, well, how do you learn how to play bebop? Exactly the same way. Mm. You listen. You know, just like, you know, at first you don't have your own thoughts. You're just mimicking words that you're hearing. But then you get a build a vocabulary. Then you start to use the same words they taught you, but you're using them in different order. And you start to think your own thoughts. And then you use the language to express your thoughts. Mm. Same with music. With bebop or funk or anything else, at first it's all osmotic. You know, you're listening, you're letting it wash over you. You're hearing a rhythm and a style and an accent, you know, of speaking a certain way of music.
Right.
Then you learn enough vocabulary to where you can speak in that same language, but with your own thoughts.
Mm. And that'll just happen, right?
But it takes a lot of work.
It takes a lot of work.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been working, like when students say, yeah, well, you know, you play that bebop stuff and everything. Yeah, I'm 60 and I started playing electric when I was
10. Yeah, and I'm still
working.
Yeah.
So if I've been playing for 50 years on this thing and another 45 on the other one, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm still hearing things like I'll hear a great player play a Wes record or a Train or somebody. Like we're going to play with Yotam this tune, Love Thy Neighbor. It's from a Train record called Stardust. And it just... I transcribed it at one point, and I used it with my students when I was teaching at City College in Harlem. And I pulled it out for this because it's one of these joyous, you know, it's in that period where he was playing over standard type tunes, but playing all his stuff.
Right.
And it's the vibe, you know, it's the phrasing. Like you said, when I was playing that thing before, it's only the phrasing, the emotional content that drew me to it. Because I've heard other people play the same notes that are in bebop. And this is the thing that I bust my students that play electric bass on all the time. They try to play a bebop thing, but then they're playing staccato every note and they got their back pickup on.
Right.
That doesn't sound anything like the expression and the rhythmic variance and the articulation differences that you hear Sonny Rollins or Train or Wayne or Miles or Freddie Hubbard play with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they play 8 million different kinds of eighth notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Freddie might go... Now, so that's a bunch of different stuff, but for me, it's a feeling.
Right.
I'm not analyzing what I'm doing.
Right. But just like the way we're talking. I'm not, you know, thinking about your grammar or syntax. I'm just listening to you talk.
But I have, like, built up all over these decades, you know, all those little expressive things. You know, that kind of stuff. It's a language that I heard so much that I finally acquired enough language to where I can hopefully put things together in a way that's more personal than just playing one transcription. Here's the other element. In order to uncover your voice, you have to embrace a lot of influences. You have to have input from a lot of places to...
You have to love music, right?
Yeah, music. And then it kind of all blends into this melting pot and out you come.
What do you say to the people? Because, you know... There are as many types of personalities in musicians as there are just in people all over the world. And some of them find it easy to be confident, to play with intention. Some people get lost in comparing themselves to others.
Right.
Which, I mean, how do you advise, especially a person who's coming up, like to kind of forge their path and not allow those things to derail them? Because I've seen it happen.
Well, super insightful what you said, because I vividly remember failing in both of those areas, like being freaked out, like in my little room, I was feeling really good. And then I got out there and here was the difference. Again, it goes back to rhythm. Sometimes you're on your bed and you think you're doing stuff and you're slowing down for the stuff that's hard and you're speeding up for the stuff that's good for you. And then you get in a gig and all of a sudden you have to fit into the time groove context. There's a window of each beat that, you know, that's happening, and it's inexorable.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you have to have intention. The biggest intention one, the most comical one for me, was when I got with Chick. I had learned about playing intentionally as a groove bass player through trial and error and then being in the studios and going, you know, going in the control room and hearing a take and that you thought was so great and you find out you're merely rushing. Or you go in there and everybody thought it sucked and then you go in there and it's like, wow, that feels great. Your emotions lied to you. Mm. So then I get the gig with Chick. So I was just analyzing that as far as a baseline thing and everything. So then I get with Chick and, you know, we're grooving under his solo. I feel great. Dave, easy time to play. They both have great time. We're grooving, we're creating all this stuff. He plays an unbelievable solo every time. And then it's my turn. And the first rehearsals were, it was like being in the ring with Ali with his comping. It was so powerful, so intentional. It was like, bam, 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 bam. You know, I felt like I was on the ropes getting hammered. And I had to learn how to play a phrase and mean it, you know, like...
Interesting. Yeah.
Play the phrase and mean it and pocket it right in the middle of the swing of the beat, or if it's a funk thing. Measure each, make it feel like it has weight and balance, and it feels good. And that's a series of articulation choices.
Right.
You know, and this is all, it's really emotional.
Yeah.
It doesn't work if it's purely cerebral or intellectual, then it sounds correct. You want it to feel great.
How important is that to you? Because I know students I teach, sometimes they're not tapping their foot, they're not moving their head, they're so nervous and stiff, and they sound that way. So
yeah. For me, it's been the opposite challenge. I'm very physical. So I'm always, sometimes, and a lot of times on sessions, I would take my shoe off because I'd be like this. And you're playing with great drummers like that, you'd be like, yeah, and we'd make a lot of noise.
And you'd
be like,
right. Can you take your shoes off? We got mics. You know?
So I had to make sure that I was channeling all my energy into the instrument, but I try to not move on stage. I can't do it. So for me, it's always been the opposite. Like, I'm very physical. My body's, because I wanted to play the drums.
So that came naturally.
So I'm still playing the drums through the bass. But and that's why I like when I sit down, the drums is very physical, you know. The bass is physical too, and the acoustic bass is very physical. So for me, yes, I have to be involved. And the one thing that I do with my students, I like them to be physical, but piano players usually are the culprit here over the years when I've taught students. When there's an ensemble playing and they're not hooking up with the drums and they're playing to their foot.
Right.
And it's not in time. It's not in time sometimes. So I say, look, you got to stop your foot and play with the drummer because he's happening. But that foot of yours is not happening. So let's get rid of that and play with him or her, you know, and then don't.
Which is about listening, right?
I mean, yes.
That's really
Rufus Reed told me something when I was a kid. I met him when I was 15. He did a clinic. He said, time and the groove and this mystical thing that we all talk about all the time is about agreement. When people come together and agree to put something somewhere or in a zone, like maybe like Elvin might play behind a little bit and Ron might play on Passion Dance on a McCoy Tyner record. Maybe Ron's up here and they agree to let the amalgamation of what they're doing make this great rubbery pocket. Sometimes you hear like bass player and drummer play exactly together for a certain tempo and it feels great. Sometimes, you know, I feel like for straight ahead jazz, I had to learn how to play relaxed on top like Ron Carter, where this way the drummer had a wider playing field. He could play around the beat, sit way back, and still the bass would keep it. And I try to tell my students this a lot of times, the drummers, sometimes they need to learn how to make the beat feel wider. And sometimes I say, look, I have to play way on top to just keep you in it, because sometimes they'll drag. They'll be like, to play wider without dragging.
Yeah.
So, and I've taught my bass students a lot about this because it's all Ron and Ray. They play on the front, but it's real relaxed. And you notice that if you go to the end of the record, it's not faster. But it took that much energy to keep the ball in the air.
Right. There's a momentum and an inertia to that.
Yeah. Sometimes that's what's ironic about Ray. All the drummers that I always talk to that played with him, they said, yeah, he played way on top. But if you listen to those Oscar Peterson records, there's agreement. He and Oscar and Ed Thigpen agree to put the beat here. It swings its butt off, and you don't really sense that it's really rushing.
Yeah.
No. Often it's not.
Yeah.
It's just locked.
Right.
Ron Carter and Tony Williams. Sometimes it's astounding how hooked up it is. It's so locked.
Yeah.
Other times you can tell they decided that they were going to step, they're going to put their foot through the floorboard, and they speed up, but they're together the whole time.
Yeah, it's insane.
So when it gets to Herbie's solo on one of those, like walking live on Miles in Europe, it's faster, but it's swinging its butt off, and they're exactly together.
Yeah.
So the other example of that in the Converse is Miles Davis Quintet live at the Black Hawk. Paul Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb, there's a couple of things where it really slows down. You hear the head in, and the tune is swinging so hard. Right. When you get to the end and the melody comes in, you go, oh my God, it's a lot slower. Mm-hmm. But you didn't notice it because they were agreeing on the time.
Right.
When you notice it is when somebody unilaterally just starts pulling at the fabric in the wrong way, away from the others. And then there's a chasm. And I did a lot of trial and error and learned by failure with young drummers when I was, you know, a little older, and then tried to pull somebody with me. It don't work. Mm. It just opens up this chasm and then there's no groove. Mm-hmm. So what I always do first, whether I'm playing with somebody younger or older, is I find where they are, I go straight to them and, you know, lock, and then maybe I can try to wiggle something out of it. Sometimes I can't. The drums are very powerful physically and sonically. If they want to stay there, you're sunk.
That's what's happening. Yeah, right.
But sometimes they're doing things on purpose. I did this thing with Bernard Purdy once, and it was live. You know, it was a rehearsal, and all these heavy things. Maceo was there, and all these guys. Even Jeff Beck played on it. It was a tribute, Fagan. Mm. You know, and we were doing all these Ray Charles things. So all through the rehearsal, he was laying back. And I could tell some of the front people were like, oh, man, come on. And he wasn't doing it. And you know what I did? I just played right with Purdy the whole time. I just agreed. And he looked at me, he was smiling, and we played. And don't you know it, on the gig that night, he put it right in there.
Mm-hmm. He was saving it.
He was saving it.
Yeah.
And, you know, truth be told, it was grooving. Whether he was on the back.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Or, you know, maybe it was a little less driving when he was laying. But, man, I was just like,
still a vibe.
It's pretty. Yeah. So, agreement. Mm. You hear those tracks that he did with Chuck Rainey, those guys, there's no debate. That's some of the most profound grooving you're going to hear.
Yeah.
Or like that agreement, like just like Willie Weeks and Fred White on the Donny Hathaway Live, their version of What's Going On is kind of swinging. Donny, everything's cool. Go ahead and grab a drummer and count that one off and see if you can make it feel like that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.